Off in the salty ocean, off where the waves roll free. The sparkling water rises, then crashes to the sea. Out amongst the breakers, you'll have no need to fear. It's true, it's the blue frontier.
Welcome to a new episode of Rising Tide, the Ocean Podcast. This is David Helvarg, and my co-host, calling in from another continent, is Vicki Nichols Goldstein.
Hello, everyone.
This week, our guest is Megan Brosnan, CEO of WildAid. WildAid is a global organization working to protect wild animals and their habitats from illegal poaching and trafficking, illegal fishing, climate change, and other impacts that have seen the loss of 70% of the world's wild animals, including large mammals, birds, and fish, just since I was a kid in the 1960s. Megan is an expert in marine enforcement, having served over 20 years with the U.S. Coast Guard, both at sea and in their Marine Resources Enforcement Program. She joined WildAid in 2017, and since then has expanded its oceans program more than tenfold to where they're now working on ocean wildlife protection in more than 16 nations. But before we get into all of that, here's some blue news you can use. Take it away, Vicki.
Thank you. Well, it might sound unimaginable, but under the Trump administration, the U.S. government canceled all subscriptions to Nature and Science magazines, two of the world's top scientific journals. These magazines are normally received by institutions like the National Institute of Health, NOAA, NASA, the Department of Energy, and the EPA, but were abruptly cut off. Science is published by the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and for decades, these journals have been a symbol of the United States leadership in advancing scientific understanding. So why cancel these crucial subscriptions? One reason may be that science, as is presented in these journals, acknowledges climate change as a real and pressing issue. This decision aligns with the administration's controversial plans to slash funding for climate and weather research programs at NOAA. And yet, as this policy unfolds, climate-related disasters continue to wreak havoc across the nation. The disconnect between policy and reality is staggering. And now, let's get back to the reality.
No, really sad. We're seeing these disasters play out every day. So, Megan, thanks for being with us today. And as we start off with most of our guests, let me ask you, how did you first connect with the ocean?
So I first connected with the ocean when I was a very young girl, and I went to a marine science camp in Connecticut where I was raised called Schooner Camp. And this is this amazing camp where they bring you to all the different marine coastal environments that you can see in Connecticut. You're tromping through mud flats, you're tromping along the beaches, you're tide pooling in the rocky intertidal zone. And I just fell in love with it through that camp and all that I learned. And then as I was moving through that time, I became a counselor and eventually, you know, decided at a young age that I wanted to work in the marine environment to protect it.
And how did that play out? How'd you move forward in life with that?
First, I thought I wanted to be a marine scientist. And then I had an experience my senior year in high school where I got to work in a science lab. And it was incredible and humbling to be able to work with scientists that were doing such important work. And I saw just how hard it was to get funding. At the time, for 18-year-old Megan, that really seemed unfair. And at the same time, I had been introduced to the Coast Guard Academy. And here was this place that offered an incredible marine science degree, a service in which women can do everything. And that was humanitarian in nature, had so many missions that were aligned with, you know, protecting the ocean, and had that benefit of giving me some adventure and and travel throughout the world. So I went to the Coast Guard Academy, graduated. I got stationed out of Cordova, Alaska. And as I was introduced to this mission of fisheries law enforcement, I suddenly came to realize just how incredibly important, you know, the fishermen complying with the rules leveling that playing field was to having a sustainable ocean and, you know, the for future generations. And I met both sides of the equation, right? I lived in a town whose economy is 100% driven by the sustainability of that fishery.
When you went offshore, what were you doing?
We were focusing primarily on halibut fleets and pollock fleets. And, you know, so one memorable middle of the night case, it was one of my first ones as the boarding officer, which means I was in charge. And the fisherman was blatantly discarding a species of fish that was less valuable that they were required to be maintaining. And I think he just thought that we weren't going to be well-versed enough in the laws to pick up on what he was doing. And, you know, we made a solid case, and he had real fines. He had impacts, you know, from there. He was pretty annoyed when he realized that we were collecting evidence on what he was doing. But yeah, I mean, it was one of those things where there was also a bit of, he clearly was one of the fishers who saw the illegal activity as being like a cost of doing business. It's interesting when with these particular fleets, you would run into two different types of fishermen in terms of how they interacted with me as a female boarding officer. There was more than a few times where I would come on board, they would be really angry, then they would see that they're talking to a woman, and it's like they just like would suddenly be like, oh no, I have to be polite to this human being. You know? Or yeah, there was the derision, the, you know, just talking down to you, and, you know, but I mean, in the end,
you did your job,
and like, it doesn't really matter. It just makes them, you know, makes them seem less impressive to you. And like, they you can like insult me as much as you want. I'm still the law enforcement officer following, you know, the rules and enforcing
my job,
because you didn't do your job. Right. So, and I had an incredibly supportive team behind me at every time, at every step there, you know, in the U.S. Coast Guard, you're lucky where you've got a really good, robust program where you've got a team of professionals behind you every step.
And the cheaters are taking away from the honest fishermen. And I think the Coast Guard at some level may be appreciated. It's a love-hate relationship with the fishing industry, but...
Exactly. No, I mean, like, nobody likes to have to stop fishing, because we all know that time is money, in order to get boarded, right? None of us like to have to do a routine traffic stop. And like you said, I mean, the vast, vast, vast majority of fishers that I interacted with were multi-generational, understood that the need... would have, you know, a beautifully organized notebook waiting for me when I walked into their cabin, you know, with all of their proper permits, knew exactly what they were doing. And that was the norm.
So what was the evolution from your like leading boarding teams to doing marine resources enforcement? What was the sort of larger mission and vision that you got into?
Yeah, so I was lucky enough, like I said, I fell in love with that mission in the Coast Guard, and I was lucky enough to be accepted in a master's degree program for the Coast Guard. And that program, I was at the University of Washington School of Marine and Environmental Affairs, shout out to them. And in that program, you're really learning, like, you need to understand the perspective of everyone around that table, right? You need to understand the science, understand the law, understand the fishers, understand the politics, understand the law enforcement. And that degree was designed to give you that collective understanding, which was incredible. I took that, went to the Coast Guard headquarters, where I ultimately was the deputy chief of the Coast Guard's National Living Marine Resources Enforcement Division. So I oversaw the policy, the training, representation to foreign countries. And in that role, we had a small part in supporting the training teams of the Coast Guard who would go to international navies, Coast Guards, right? We would be requested by these countries who wanted help in protecting their resources because they understood how incredibly important their marine resources were. And I saw how grateful, how impactful our work was, and how needed it was that it not be just a one-off bit of support. So ultimately, I had the opportunity to go into the reserves for the Coast Guard and full-time shift to a nonprofit role. And I was working for the Pew Charitable Trusts on their ending illegal fishing project for many years, and then shifted to consulting.
When you were thinking about nonprofit work and you ended up at Wild Aid, was that a goal? Was that a vision? Or I'm looking for that transition for how you landed in this great position.
It was. So I was first made aware of Wild Aid when I was still wearing the uniform full time because Wild Aid put on this Marine Protected Area Enforcement Conference. And we learned about their system, what we now call the Marine Protection System, right? And when I transitioned away from Pew, was doing consulting work, I actually started out with Wild Aid. I was a consultant for them. When they asked me, then it was Marcel Biguet, the former Marine Program Director, and he asked if I wanted to do some training for the Palawan Protected Area Network Rangers. Palau's Protected Area Network is their equivalent of a National Park Service. As a consultant, I was like, let me think about this for 1 second. Do I want to be paid to travel to Palau to work with amazingly dedicated individuals? Yes. Yes. I had already gone to all those amazing places. And I must have done well when I was, you know, that trainer, because a couple of years later, I've got my, at that time, 3-month-old son in my arms, and Marcel keeps on calling me. I'm like, geez, Marcel, I can barely sleep. Okay. You know, pick up. And he's like, Megan, I've got an opportunity for you. I'm like, okay. Here I'm thinking like deputy, something else. He's like, I want you to take over the program.
The whole ocean program for
the whole ocean program. I'm like, how about in 2 years? He's like, how about in 2 months? So anyway, that was the transition. And it's been great because I've been able to travel with my children quite a bit.
And now it's like Wild Aid's like many conservation group. Even before you, I think it was before you got there, Wild Aid was got a lot of fame for its work around shark finning and really changing attitudes in China about consuming shark fin soup.
Yeah. So Wild Aid has been working in the ocean space for 25 years. What many people don't realize actually is that both our marine protection program, the working with law enforcement, and our demand reduction work and our consumer, you know, engagement work have both been going on for that full time. It's just that one has been much quieter than the other. So our shark fin work. So we, as Wild Aid was founded and moving forward, it became very, very clear that, you know, millions, you know, hundreds of millions of sharks were being killed each year. And at that time, mostly for their fins. And China was the primary consumer of those shark fins. And it was problematic. There were quite a few threatened and endangered species being tangled in to that consumption. And we began working over a series of years with, in many cases, eventually the invitation of the Chinese government, with big celebrities such as Jackie Chan and Yao Ming, to go through a series of communications campaigns that first sought to educate the Chinese public. There were many people. So if you directly translate what the words are for shark fin soup, it's actually shark wing soup. So there were people who did not understand that it was actually shark fins in that soup. There were people who were under the impression that the shark fins would grow back. Mm-hmm. So there was at first a real need to educate. And it took many years. You don't shift a whole culture overnight. But ultimately, the Chinese government chose to ban the serving of shark fin soup at all government entities. And the consumption of shark fin soup reduced 80% in China.
We know that illegal wildlife trade is 20 billion plus. Organized crime overlaps human trafficking, drugs, wildlife. They don't care as long as they can make a buck. And you create marine protected areas that are only as good as the enforcement that takes place within them. So you're coming out of law enforcement, out of the Coast Guard. You arrive at Wild Aid in 2017. And what's this tenfold increase? What are the kind of ocean programs that you've overseen?
Yeah, when I came to Wild Aid, we had already developed years of experience in the Galapagos National Park. When we started there, the enforcement officers would be seizing vessels that had tens of thousands of sharks, you know, with equivalents of shark fins on board. And we had learned through that time period just what all was needed. Like I described, you need that whole system. You can't just look at the fancy tools, some good policies, some good procedures, some good training is really needed as well. And yet at the same time, when I was first coming to Wild Aid, the 10 by 20, right? 10% of the oceans by 2020 was just starting to come to a close. People were realizing both that we were not going to reach that goal and that 30% by 2030 was going to be needed. And at the same time, we were coming to an era when I took over. The Magnuson-Stevens Act had been moved through, had been in place in the United States. That was had come into place about 30 years previously. So that meant I had a whole crop of marine resource enforcement officers, people who had actually worked in that relatively new field, who were retiring and who, like Megan, when she was a consultant, were like, Megan, you want to pay me to travel to Cocos Island off Costa Rica and help them protect that incredible place? Yes. Okay, Megan, you can pay me for less than I am worth. and I will put my heart and soul into this work.
So have you recruited more former Coast Guard and NOAA and fisheries observers and people with the water experience to help expand this program?
Yeah, exactly. The goal for me is that I can visit a location, but I'm not needed in that location.
Do you love the salty characters and ocean champions we have on The Rising Tide? So do we, and we're dedicated to bringing inspiring stories and voices that make waves. But here's the catch. We need your support to keep the tide rolling. A tax-deductible donation at bluefront.org will help keep The Rising Tide on the air and online. If you're ready and able to amplify these salty voices for the sea, dive in with a donation, big or small. Visit bluefront.org and join the movement. And now, back to the show.
I see what you created. And then I look around the ocean and I see the tremendous need. And I see lots of NGOs who want to do wonderful things. What is your criteria? How do you actually select your criteria and your organization so you are getting the right type of mix of people on the ground to merge with your expert volunteers, so to speak, that you bring in to help?
Yeah, absolutely. As we get deeper and deeper into details here, you're going to sense a theme. One of it is that I really like templates and spreadsheets. Uh-huh. Of course, it's always adapted for each location, but, you know, maritime law enforcement's not rocket science, so we don't need to make it difficult. You can have a clear criteria. Same thing, what makes a good local partner? The first component was we needed either an area, marine protected area, to have been established already, or they were very close to the point where that was going to be made, right? If there's no laws on the overseeing the enforcement of the, or, you know, managing that area, we can't help them enforce the laws that do not yet exist. Second was that we needed really strong indications of political will at multiple levels of the political structure. So that meant we were working with local partners, the folks who are actually on the water doing the patrolling, who are dedicated, who wanted our support and wanted to move forward. And we had at least a mid-level political person, the person who could, the first level person who could put resources to patrols, who said, yes, we want your support. And that could be a nonprofit, that could be a government entity, that could be, in a few instances, even a community entity. It just needs to be people who, last criteria, actually have the authority to do the enforcing, right? Or are closely connected with the folks who have the authority to do the enforcing. One common misconception people have is that they think that the world is just too rife with corruption and nobody cares, right? And I think we are lucky in that we see a lot of people who actually do care and are doing great work on a regular basis. And I want to just put out there that there are more local partners who need our help than we are currently able to support.
Exactly. I was so curious about that. So yeah. Are you open to bringing on new projects? Or are you like, we have our list?
No, we're always open for new projects. And as you know, and we have now a solid presence in Southeast Asia, especially with our Philippines program. We have a solid presence in the Caribbean, a solid presence in the Eastern Tropical Pacific, the Central Africa, and the Western Indian Ocean. Like, we have these flagship programs that we've been working with for several years now in each of those locations, and we're ready to help them build their networks.
So clearly the aim of 30 by 30, protecting 30% of all the planet's lands and waters by 2030, is not being realized, but there are some steps. I mean, French Polynesia just announced the world's largest marine protected area, and the French have pretty good enforcement. They'll do what they need to do. Maybe you could just give us one or two examples of your work in, say, Gabon in Africa or the Philippines, how that's working out on the ground, on the water.
Yeah, so I could start in the Philippines because we were there just a month ago. There we are working in a collaboration with RARE. They're the nonprofit RARE, which is they have a Fish Forever program, which has been working in the Philippines for many years. And they have been crafting community managed fisheries, right? Where the local mayors, the local communities make the sacrifices, put in the hard, the scientific, collection work, and create their local marine protected areas. But then what happens when you start having more fish than your neighbors down the road? You become a target, right? So our work in supporting them and now in supporting the Filipino government has been included working with the local communities, supporting the Bante Dagat, which is literally fishermen who work to protect their own resources, all the way up to the Philippines National Police. And that means we work with all those levels of people. We identify where the gaps are. How are these illegal fishers coming in? And then we make a plan with them iteratively to fill those gaps. That can be tools. We donated a patrol vessel. That can be methods. We came to find out that the biggest gap, why in a certain area, blast fishing, which is using homemade dynamite to fish, the biggest gap on that was that they didn't have dive gear, dive equipment. So when a blast fisher saw you coming, they would throw all the evidence over the side. And the patrol vessels had no way of collecting that evidence in order to then ensure that justice came forward. So sometimes it can be something as simple as that, making sure that they have the equipment to collect the evidence and then they know how to get that evidence to the legal place.
With your emphasis on marine protected areas, and then with Trump's opening up the U.S. protected or marine protected areas to other activities, how is that impacting your work nationally and globally with all of these MPAs under threat?
So yeah. We don't currently work nationally in the United States. As David had mentioned, right, if the French aren't enforcing their own laws, it's not a lack of capacity or understanding, it's a lack of political will. And that's not what our specific expertise is. And you can say the same in the United States, right? In general, the U.S. Coast Guard, NOAA, many of the state fish and wildlife agencies know what they're doing. And if they're not doing their job, that is for other political advocacy organizations to pull forward. That said, we're very well known as a U.S. organization, right? And if we, when we enter into a new country, even if it's through a local partner. For example, the reason why we now have a Cuban program is because our partners in the Galapagos introduced us to the Cuban government as a good partner.
It's almost as if when U.S. people help other nations protect their environment, we get increased credibility in the world.
It's almost as if. And, big picture, there's always that chance, right? We're always very concerned that if U.S. relations deteriorate to a level between two countries, that really high-level shutdown of communication is going to happen, that we could get caught up in that. But to date, we are always honest of whom we are. We're always following local laws. And our local partners, we're meeting needs that our local partners have.
I wanted to know what's your vision for the role of conservation organizations like WildAid and others that you work with in protecting the world's oceans over the next maybe 5-10 years?
So WildAid has a unique place in the ocean conservation space in that we are inherently collaborative, right? WildAid is all about supporting governments and achieving their environmental leadership goals, right? Wherever we agree with them, we're moving that forward. We can do that with our law enforcement capacity building support, or we can be doing that with our communications support, with some behind the scenes policy advice support, where we are helping them to drive the discourse, to drive the hard conversations that are needed to shift human behavior. And I think that's an incredibly important thing, right? I think people at one point thought, at least this is what I was taught back in grad school, that globalization was going to bring everyone together. And what we're seeing is while it can do that, it also can make it incredibly easier to just be at odds with each other.
Thank you, Megan Bronson, CEO of WildAid, for joining us on the Rising Tide Ocean podcast. And good luck in all of your endeavors. It's pretty amazing work.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us on the Rising Tide Ocean podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and leave us a review or share it with your friends and other ocean lovers. Follow us on Instagram and visit bluefront.org for more updates and additional resources. Rising Tide is a production of Blue Frontier, co-hosted by David Helbart and me, Vicki Nichols-Goldstein of the Inland Ocean Coalition, with production support from Holden Hardcastle of Fluid Studios, Natasha Benjamin, and Nick Paz, and editing services provided by Charles Landon of Studio Cape May. Thanks for listening, and until next time, stay hopeful and stay salty.
Off in the salty ocean, off where the waves roll free, the sparkling water rises, then crashes to the sea. Out amongst the breakers, you'll have no need to fear. It's true, it's the blue frontier. Tear, tear. Off in the salty ocean, off to the blue frontier.
Sparky, come here, buddy.
Sparky! There you are, good boy, Sparky.